Melbourne Writers Festival acknowledges the peoples of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land on which this event was recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present. Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation recorded live at our 2023 festival. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, please consider making a donation to Melbourne Writers Festival. As a not-for-profit organisation, inspiring, thoughtful and challenging discussions like the one you are about to listen to are only made possible thanks to the generous support of people like you. Learn how you can be part of our community at mwf.com.au/support. I hope you enjoy this episode. This event was presented in partnership with ABCRN and was proudly supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to a Melbourne Writers Festival event, Labours of Love. I'm so glad we can provide this refuge for you from the cold outside. Aren't you glad you chose to do this, not knowing what the weather was going to be? And we can provide this place of refuge. Think of this as the collective hearth of storytellers, and we can find out how our storytellers, how our best storytellers think and how they write their books. I'd like to acknowledge that we're on the lands of the Kulin Nation, particularly the lands of the Woiwurrung Wurundjeri people, and I pay my respects to elders past and present, in fact, all First Nations people. I am Sarah Lestrange from The Book Show at Radio National. I'm sure all of you listen, yes? I hope you do. We speak to writers, the best writers from the English-speaking world every week on Mondays. Of course, we're available as podcasts. And there's something special for you at the moment there. I've produced and presented a series called Fakes and Frauds. Everyone loves a scandal, right? So I've looked at some really kind of recent Australian literary scandals from the last 30 years, and I unpack the scandal as it unfolded. And some of them are truly explosive. So you'll want to sign up. Go onto the ABC Listen app and follow The Book Show and you'll get them all. I'm still making them. I've got the fifth one to make, but you'll love it. And what else do I need to let you know? The session is in fact being recorded for possible broadcast on The Book Show, and then depends how we go. There may well be audience questions. We're just going to feel that one. And the author's books will be available for signing at the end, and there'll be volunteers able to show you how to do that and where to go. So let's meet our wonderful authors. Two debut novelists. Their books are somewhat different, but there are themes that sort of cut across both of them. Tracy Lien and Nina Wan have written these really gorgeous books. Tracy's book is All That's Left Unsaid. It's set in Cabramatta, Sydney in the 1990s and follows Kee Tran as she tries to find out how and why her beautiful, smart brother was murdered at a restaurant on the night of his Year 12 graduation. It's really a devastating book, but it's so beautifully written. And she joins us all the way from New York. And Nina's novel is The Albatross, and that's a golfing term I learned. I'm not a golfer. And it's about Primrose Lee, who's sort of at a crossroads in her life, trying to work out how she got to where she is. You know, she's living in Melbourne. Her husband's recovering from cancer. He's in remission. But their relationship has, it's not so tight anymore. And she's sort of wondering why she is obsessively cleaning all the time. So as I mentioned, though, you know, these novels have similar themes. So the ties that bind, migration, and also what it means to be a model minority. So please give them both a warm welcome. Firstly, I want to get to know each of you a bit more, and I think the best way to find out about someone is to find out about what they were doing as a child and whether they were reading. So, Tracy, were you a big reader growing up in Sydney?
No. So, like, when I listen to interviews with other authors and they say things like, you know, I was a bookworm as a child, or I started reading when I was in the womb, I'm always like, oh, that's such, like, a wonderful story that I wish I could tell. But as a kid, I spent so much time watching TV. Judge Judy, Oprah, Ricky Lake, The Bold and the Beautiful, circa 1999. And I think what I was drawn to was the drama. And so I loved storytelling and I loved drama, and it was free on TV, so I got my fix there. And so I was like, well, if it's right here, why would I go look anywhere else? And obviously, I have since broadened my palette and started reading a lot more, but I'd say for most of my childhood and adolescence, with the exception of Harry Potter, there was just so much, like nutritionally bankrupt television. Yeah.
It obviously did something for you. Nina, you grew up in Shanghai. What was the role of reading for you?
Oh, well, so I grew up in Shanghai and I actually came to Australia at the age of 10. So I would have loved to have just straight away started reading English books, but unfortunately I didn't have the language. So really for 2 years I was kind of in a bit of a cocoon because I was always trying to work out what people were saying, you know, what they meant, whether they were even talking to me. So there was probably a two-year kind of drought in terms of reading. And I remember probably the first English book that I ever read was The Babysitter's Club. And I thought, wow, this is great. You know, I can actually read this book from cover to cover. And so it sort of started rolling from there. And Sarah, you talked about literature scandals earlier, and actually one of the early memories for me was my father taking me into the Angus and Robertson store on Chapel Street and buying me a copy of a book called The Hand That Signed the Paper. And he said,
Helen Demidenko.
Yes.
The big one. The big scandal.
Or Darville, right? That well, was her.
That's the story, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. So, and he said, this has just won a really big award. There's a lot of scandal around it, but that, you know, but it's still a great book, despite the scandal. I'm sure it's very well written. So I read that. I don't think I understood much of it at that age, but I just have a very vivid memory of that. And then from there, I read all sorts of things, you know, all the classics. My father had very limited understanding of, you know, English literature, so he would recommend to me the really classic stuff like Jane Austen and, you know, Charles Dickens and so on. So I really kind of devoured those kinds of books throughout my teenage years.
And did you always know you wanted to be a writer?
Yeah, I had known that since I was a small child. So I used to watch my grandfather, who was a literature professor in Shanghai, and he was always writing in his study. And because he was sort of both very long-sighted and very short-sighted, he would have his sort of glasses on his forehead and he would have his notepad sort of here and he'd be writing like this. And I just was so fascinated by just the action of putting pen to paper, you know. And my grandmother, my grandfather, because he had the most horrible handwriting, my grandmother would then have to transcribe it in her own notebook. So they would both be writing kind of side by side, and there was just such synchronicity and such sort of mutual respect in that vision of the two of them together that it really kind of inspired me and made me think, oh yeah, I think I'd like to be a writer myself one day.
Amazing. And what about for you, Tracy? When did Judge Judy sort of translate into wanting to be a writer?
Right, so I always wanted to be a journalist, not necessarily a writer. And for me, it started with Dolly magazine, which, you know, no longer exists now. But I remember reading it when I was 13 and just loving the fact that I could read a story about someone and it would sort of open my world in some way, or it would give me empathy for someone, or it would teach me something about a community. And coming from Southwest Sydney, it felt very, yeah, I felt like my world was very small. And so reading a certain article would sort of expand my world. And then I would look at the masthead and see, oh, here's career progression. 1 month someone would be sort of an editorial assistant, and then 6 months later I would see that they were a features writer. So I was like, there is a career attached to this. So that's when I decided I want to be a journalist too. And then by the time I was old enough to do an internship at Dolly, I had grown out of Dolly. But I stuck with it, and I was like, okay, I'm going to study journalism. I interned at newspapers, and then eventually got to the LA Times. And yeah, like the goal was always to tell stories that would sort of affect people in such a way that they wouldn't forget it. You know, like they would perhaps have a bit more empathy for someone, perhaps their worldview would change in some small way. And so that was always the appeal for me.
Mm. And Nina, when you're sort of in that 2 year bubble where you're sort of not sure if people are talking to you or talking to the person next to you, and you're sort of working out social cues as well, did that sort of sense of dislocation, do you think that gave you a writer's viewpoint?
Yeah, I think it triggers a kind of process of internalization in that, because you can't outwardly express your thoughts and opinions to people, you almost kind of start talking to yourself a bit more. And so there's a great world of conversation happening inside your head. So I'm an only child as well, so I didn't have, you know, a brother or a sister to talk to. My parents were always working, so I just remember being in this tiny little apartment by myself, and my parents would say, whoever knocks on the door, don't answer, you know, because it could be... It was the time when Carmen Chang had, you know, gone missing, so it's like, don't answer the door. So I was in this little apartment, just really, yeah, talking to myself. And there's something happens in the brain which is very funny, because you sort of start off talking to yourself in Chinese. And then at some point it just sort of flips and you start talking to yourself in English. And you go, oh, wow, okay. So now I really feel like I'm in the right place. and that took about, yeah, it took about 2 years. But it was... you know, while it was my memory of those 2 years is probably somewhat silent, because I didn't understand a lot of what people were saying, it was an incredibly rich time internally, I would say. And I think that really helped my writing later on. And when I started writing The Albatross, I wasn't really planning on writing so many flashbacks to the 90s. But my mind was just naturally drawn to that direction, just because I just had so much material from back then kind of banked up inside my head.
Mm. Mm. And Tracy Lien and Nina Wan, both of you, as we've discussed, have got backgrounds in journalism, and both of the main characters in your debut novels have backgrounds in journalism too. So, Nina, how did you end up in journalism?
Yeah, I had a great time in journalism. So I went into journalism after quitting a highly, highly lucrative job in investment banking, much to the horrors of almost everyone around me. It was a very un-Asian thing to do. but it was great. So, I mean, my salary went from, you know, top of the ladder to rock bottom, right? But it was so liberating, because it was the first time that someone actually paid me to write. You know, it wasn't necessarily writing fiction, which is what I always wanted to do, but it was writing. And it was a way to justify to my very conservative, very traditional parents that it's okay, I can still put food on the table, despite not pursuing law or medicine or commerce, right? So it was very, yeah, it was a very rich time in my life. And I wrote a daily share market column, which kind of felt like living in a fictitious world anyways, because the share market is this sort of its own little universe, right? Like it doesn't really exist, but it sort of does. And things move up and down according to whatever people are saying. And the worst of human emotions take root in the share market, you know, and you see the greed, the fear of missing out, but also the fear of losing. So, and I was there through a whole cycle from rampant bull market to the global financial crisis. So it was really interesting to actually witness that. And yeah, it just, yeah, it was a very fascinating insight into a unique little world.
And Tracy, your beat was tech reporting for the LA Times. At what point did you sort of say to yourself, I really want to write a novel now?
So around the time that Donald Trump was elected, my job changed a lot because it went from covering Silicon Valley technology and business to covering the crisis of the day, and there was a new crisis every day. And I felt like whatever I wrote today would be irrelevant by tomorrow. And I started reflecting on, well, why did I get into journalism to begin with? What was the girl who was reading Dolly? What drew her to journalism and storytelling? And it was telling stories that have an impact that perhaps will be relevant a week from now, a year from now. And so that's when I started having a bit of an identity crisis, because I was like, okay, I'm in my 30s. I've only ever been a journalist. And now I don't think I want to do it anymore. Who am I if not an LA Times journalist? And an editor I had at the time said, have you considered going to get a master's degree in creative writing? And I said, absolutely not. Because it didn't seem like where would that lead? And it wasn't really my desire to write a novel. I knew I was interested in fiction, but I didn't know if I could write it. So I applied to programs that were fully funded. I didn't want to go into debt for it. And while I was there, that's when I realized, oh, I actually do want to write a novel. And having the journalism training was really helpful for that, because initially it held me back in the sense that I was really scared of making things up, because I was like, as a journalist, you can't do that. But then as a novel writer, like, that's the name of the game. So once I got over that hump, like the discipline of being a journalist, the discipline of writing every day, you're finding hooks, telling a story that's interesting, that all came into play. And that was how I was able to write All That's Left Unsaid in the time that I did.
And Nina, so you went from the top rung, you know, of earnings to then journalism to then being a writer.
Yeah. My husband often joke that, like, my pay just gets less and less. It's like, what is going on? I should be going the other way. But, yes.
So what led to that shift? You know, we've heard Tracy just wanted to find something new. Yes. What about you?
So several years ago, my family was in a kind of a point of crisis. My husband was diagnosed with cancer very suddenly, and it was a very traumatic time for the whole family. But what came out of that was a lot of material, which is what writers value most of all. So by the year 2020, when the whole family was in lockdown and I was sort of near insanity because I had just homeschooled the kids while working from home, and my husband was home and we had a dog and a rabbit and all of that. Anyway, I said, I'm just going to try and make some time for myself. And what would I do with that time? Well, I have kind of an inkling of an idea for a novel. So I will sit down, find time whenever I can, and try to do this. And so Tracy mentioned the kind of the discipline that journalism gives you. And that was really useful to me too, because it teaches you how to write with almost no inspiration whatsoever, right? Like, you just treat it like a job. Whenever you have time, even if it's 5 minutes, you just sit down and type. And so that's how I came to write The Albatross in the year of COVID lockdown.
I think there was a pandemic of writing during COVID as well. There's a lot of debut novels landing on my desk. So let's now talk about the books. You've met the authors. Let's find out about their books now. Tracy, your novel is All That's Left Unsaid. It's about a sister's grief and her need to find out what happened to her younger brother and why he was murdered. So how did your main character, Key, land on the page?
Right, so I had started working on a short story collection. And when I was in grad school, I was writing these stories, and pretty much Every piece was set in Cabramatta, which some of you might know is kind of like a refugee enclave in southwest Sydney. And all the stories were told from the point of view of young girls. And what I really wanted to get across was, yeah, I want the reader to know how it feels. Now, what does that mean? Well, I want people to know how it feels to have grown up Asian Australian in the 90s. Well, what does that mean? It's like, well, I want people to understand the myth of the model minority and how awful it feels to live with conditional citizenship. Now, conditional citizenship is like, okay, here's an example. Growing up, you're told from a young age, you're as Aussie as they come. You know, you belong. Australia loves multiculturalism. You're dinky die. Let's learn the second verse of the national anthem together. But then you realize at some point, oh, the fair go applies to a lot of people, but it doesn't apply to you or to people who look like you. There is an asterisk next to your citizenship. Your citizenship is conditional on your impeccable behavior. It's conditional on your gratitude. And if you do anything to step out of line, then you risk being perceived as a nuisance or a threat. And we saw this with the early days of the pandemic, right? And especially in America, where, you know, Asians were once considered the success stories, and suddenly they were carriers of the Kung Flu. And the majority, the opinion of the majority turned on a dime. And so wanting to explore that through these characters, one of the characters was a woman named Keitran. And she had lost her brother, obviously made up, but she lost her brother to a murder in a busy restaurant. And the police are completely stumped. There were about a dozen witnesses and they all claimed to have seen nothing. So she takes it upon herself to track down the witnesses to find out what happened and why they each refused to speak. And the reason I made her a journalist wasn't necessarily because I was a journalist. It was because I wanted a protagonist who was really active. So I learned a lot from murder mysteries. And if you think of the most popular murder mysteries, the protagonist is a detective, right? And they're detectives because they have to solve the crime, like it's their job. And also they have a lot of access to, you know, evidence and they can track down witnesses. And I was like, okay, I don't want to have a detective as my protagonist, but what's the next best thing? It's like, well, a journalist kind of has some of the skills of a detective in the sense of like the curiosity, the willingness to go out there. And so it was like arming Key with the skills of a journalist by making her a journalist, but then also making her the type of character who is sort of burdened by conditional citizenship.
Mm-hmm. And Nina, your novel is The Albatross, and it's about Primrose Lee. She's questioning her life decisions. Mm. How does she land on the page?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because when I first started writing The Albatross, I feel like I was almost writing a bit of a semi-memoir in some ways. The book begins with Primrose somehow winding up on a dilapidated suburban golf course nearing the end of its days, and for seemingly no reason whatsoever, starts to engage in this weird activity called golfing. And that was me several years ago. I was in a really downward spiral. As I mentioned, my husband was very ill, and I think I became so depressing as a person that even my husband wanted to get me out of the house. So he bought me a set of golf clubs and said, I think you should give this a go. Now, some people in dire moments turn to drugs, alcohol, whatever, skydiving. And for me, I started golfing. I went down to the local golf course, what was then known as the Elsternwick Public Golf Course on Nepean Highway. And it was the last few weeks before it was about to be shut down after having been there for a century. And I just played. I played through that whole Melbourne winter, and the weather was terrible, like it is today. But there was something really profoundly meditative. I mean, I discovered two things while I was there. I discovered that I was a terrible golfer and that I was never going to get any good at it. But there was something profoundly freeing about being terrible at it. What it reminded me, actually, was something I ought to have known all along, which is that there are things in life that you cannot control, and that you just have to be terrible at it, and you just have to keep walking forward and be terrible at it. And so I knew I wanted to write a novel that began with a woman at a crossroad in her life who ends up on a golf course in the rain. And that's sort of how that began. But then halfway through, like, my imagination kind of got carried away. And I was like, wouldn't it be lovely if it was a great romance as well, like a great love story? And then somewhere further along, it was like, it's not enough for it to be just a love story, but let's make it a love story with two Chinese Australians at its heart. And let's just insist that that kind of love story has a place in mainstream popular Australian culture. And then while we're at it, let's just tell people about some of the challenges of being Chinese Australian, particularly in the age of geopolitical tension, when the country of your birth is the enemy state, basically, you know, the global pariah, and you are living in the West, and how that affects your perception of yourself and perhaps other people's perception of you as well.
So already you can sort of hear the threads that sort of cross over, even though these are really quite different books. And so, Tracy, can you take us back to Cabramatta in the 90s and what was happening there? Because you were just a kid then, so you put your research into action and you found out more about this time. But what was happening in Cabramatta in the 90s that sort of frames the setting for, you know, this murder that's occurred?
Yeah, so in the 90s, Cabramatta was known as the heroin capital of Australia. And the novel is set in 1996 in Cabramatta for a number of reasons. One was that, you know, given that there was, I guess, so much tension, it was a predominantly Southeast Asian community with, at one point, a 100% white police force. You know, and then also in 1996, it was the year that Pauline Hanson gave her maiden speech to Parliament. And I was 8 years old at the time, and I remember watching that speech being delivered on television. You know, hearing the words like, I'm worried that Australia is being swamped by Asians. Yes. They form ghettos and do not assimilate. Again, hearing that as an eight-year-old, that was the first time I had seen a person with authority say something that I knew was bad with impunity. And so that stuck with me. And then so those two things just sort of like, you know, remained with me. And then I remember reading, like going back and doing research, looking at the news articles that were written about Cabramatta throughout the 90s, and the headlines were all like, it's like a war zone. It's like gangland violence. And I was like, okay, I'm sure that was true, but my own memories of Cabramatta are of home. And so there's this disconnect there. You know, like, how is it that for people outside of Cabramatta, it seemed like this terrifying place? And yet for me living there, it was just, okay, this is where we ate, this is where we shopped, this is where we lived. And, you know, all those things could exist. And so that was, I guess, my reason for wanting to set it in the 90s.
And so, and looking at the thrust of the novel of Key trying to find out what happened to her brother, she talks to all of the witnesses, and many of them, because many of them didn't want to talk to the police. Why was that?
So one of the things I really wanted to explore was the idea that no community is a monolith. So we often hear of, say, like the Asian Australian community or the Lebanese Australian community or people who live in Footscray versus people who live in Fitzroy versus people who live in Brighton, right, all being a certain way. And that's just not true. I mean, sure, there are stereotypes and, like, obviously a lot of people do conform to stereotypes, but here we have a community, like, in all that's left unsaid, we have a group of people who live in the same place, share the same language, are all in Australia for a similar reason. They all witness the same murder. They all refuse to speak to the police, and yet they all do it for different reasons. You know, some of them are skeptical of the police. They don't trust the police because of their own prior experience with law enforcement. Some of them are superstitious. You know, some of them believe that there's simply no point. Some of them are sort of like fatalistic or nihilistic. So everyone has a different reason. And in sort of exploring that, I wanted to make the point to readers that we're just like everyone else. which is to say we're just as complicated as everyone else. Within a community, we're just as wonderful and petty and stubborn and flawed. We're just as capable of success as we are of failure. And if you realize that we're just like you, whoever you are, then how can you justify treating us differently? That was it.
Yeah. And Nina, we're going to talk about golf now. Bit of a jump. But I think we need to sort of find out about what this term, the albatross, means.
Yeah, so the albatross is pretty much the rarest thing in golf. It's a 3-under par, and it's scored when you are on the longest holes on a golf course. So imagine 500-600 metres from tee to hole, and you get the ball into the hole in 2 strokes. Now, somewhat counterintuitively, an albatross is way rarer than a hole-in-one. Just to put it into some sort of context.
I had no idea about that.
Yeah, so it's rarer than being struck by lightning. So to put it into context, so on the professional golf tour every year, you will see probably around 30 hole-in-ones. In the last 100 years, there's been about a dozen albatrosses. Tiger Woods has never had one, to my knowledge. So this is how rare it is. And what I really liked about the albatross was the fact that it isn't a hole-in-one. You know, like, nobody scores a hole-in-one and says, oh, you know, I meant to do that, you know. A hole-in-one is a fluke. But an albatross, because it takes 2 consecutive good shots to get there, it becomes a much more intentional and deliberate act. And it transcends something that's a mere accident of luck. And in this book, The Albatross, it becomes a bit of a metaphor for the central character, for Primrose and the boy that she loved in high school, who by coincidence is now living across the street. She's forced to re-examine long-buried feelings for him and what that actually still means in the light of the present. And it's sort of, so the 2 strokes becomes a kind of story about first love and second chances.
And I have to tell you that I was able to apply this thinking in my own life after having spoken to Nina. So I had no idea that golf could provide life lessons.
Yeah. And I didn't either. You know, I had this impression of golf as something played by men in, you know, checkered vests and like flat caps smoking a cigar or something. But actually, if you go to a suburban golf course on a weekday, in the rain, please go in the rain, because much more poetic in the rain. You see all sorts of just ordinary people, elderly people that can hardly walk, but they're trudging up towards the green with just like a single club in their hand. They're trying to do this thing, you know. Women of a certain age who now have don't have children to worry about anymore, and they're out there playing this thing. It's a game for really everyone. And I was actually surprised to learn that Mary of Scots was apparently the first woman to have played golf. And being a lady, she wouldn't carry her clubs herself. She got someone else to carry it. And thereby, she invented the profession of caddying. So there's all sorts of fascinating people that play golf. Like, the most unlikely is probably Alice Cooper, the rock star. You know,
The rock star with the makeup and everything.
Yeah, with the makeup and everything, right? And he started playing golf after coming out of a battle with alcoholism. And he suddenly found himself with all this time that he would normally spend drinking. And he went, oh, I'll start playing golf. And he's superb at it. He's, you know, he's like professional level. It's a thing for everyone. Yeah.
Is he wearing the tartan?
No. I feel like he just wears like a black t-shirt and jeans or something.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I would have liked to see him with a tartan. So you've both mentioned some similar ideas about model minority and conditional citizenship, but if you say those terms, they don't make a novel, do they?
No.
So you've got to create your characters and your plot and really give you've got to make your readers want to keep going. Mm. But the thing that I found really interesting in both of your books is that both of your characters are just worried about being good. They have to behave. And Tracy, you know, Key is always talking about good and naughty behaviour. What does that mean for her and how she lives her life?
Right, so the thing with the myth of the model minority is that if you buy into it, you believe that if only you are well-behaved enough, if you are successful enough, if you follow a certain set of rules that haven't been verbalized by anyone and yet we all know what they are, then you will get a seat at the table. You'll get to belong. You'll get to be, you'll get to be one of everyone else. And it is such a restrictive and oppressive way of living. It's such a burden as well for a number of reasons. One is because not everyone is going to fit into that mold. But two, if you don't fit into that mold, what does that mean for you? Does that mean you don't get to belong? So there's a real sense of erasure that happens. And, you know, to your point, that theme does not make a novel. And in fact, that theme can be quite weighty because it's essentially saying, this is a book about race, right? And for a lot of people, they recoil when they hear that, or they might think, I'll get around to that, you know, but it sounds like it's homework. And so I was really cognizant of that when I was writing this novel. And I read this wonderful quote by Viet Thanh Nguyen, who won the Pulitzer for The Sympathizer. And he said, a lot of novels that are politically or historically concerned tend to be long on mood but short on entertainment. And why can't a novel do it all?
Yeah, and so we know novels can.
So The Sympathizer tackles issues of colonialism and American imperialism, and it's a spy novel. You know, if we think of some of the most riveting works that are also emotionally impactful, they combine elements of genre. Miracle Creek by Angie Kim is about the immigrant experience and disability and motherhood, and it's a legal thriller. Disappearing Earth by Julia Phillips, it's about violence against women, and yet it opens with a kidnapping. And so I was like, okay, knowing that I want to write a book that tackles some weighty issues, let's try to make it entertaining. And what are the books that once I start reading, I can't put them down? And a lot of them were mysteries, a lot of them were thrillers. I learned so much from Jane Harper, like reading the first line of The Dry, I was like, okay, she hooks you right away. I need to learn how to do that. What are the tricks and techniques that I can learn to make my novel propulsive?
And so Denny sort of, in a way, represents that paradox of the model minority. He's smart and clever and does really well at school, but then he's murdered and it's linked to this heroin epidemic. And the other memorable character in your book, Tracy, is Minnie. I really liked her because she's so the opposite of me. Like, she's really challenging. She's always pushing Key, you know, why are you doing that? Why are you saying that? Why don't you stand up for yourself? And the thing is, for most of the book, she's actually not present. She's just this person sitting on Key's shoulder, sort of nattering in her ear because they haven't been in contact for quite a while. What was the significance of Minnie for you?
I really wanted to explore the complexity of female friendship. Like, I think there are few relationships that people have that are as intense as the best friend you have in high school, especially if, you know, you identify as female. Where it's a relationship where you love and hate the person in equal measure. It's where you want to be better than them, but you don't want them to compete with you. You want them to agree with you, but you also want to be different from them. And we all have like a version of that. And so I decided to like play that out to, to its extreme in this case. So if Key is this put together, I'm a rule follower, I'm going to be good, I'm going to be accepted, Minnie then sort of nudges her and is like, why? You know, why are you doing that? You think it's actually going to pay off? Try it. See how it works out for you. So I think it was fun to sort of have that foil.
And Nina, in terms of this idea of model minority, you sort of come at it in a different way, in that there are different Chinese characters, different characters with Chinese backgrounds have different backgrounds
yes.
and histories within Australia. Mm. And so Nina's old love interest from high school is Peter, and he's actually...
Primrose's old love interest.
What did I just say?
You said Nina's. My husband's sitting right there, so I just have to correct you right there.
Okay, good. Yeah, I never confuse main characters with the author.
It's okay.
Thank you for correcting me. Not at all embarrassing. All right, so let me say Primrose. Primrose's old love interest, Peter. So she went out with him in high school. And his family actually come from fifth generation Australian Chinese, whereas she's from, you know, new migrant background. So... How is it affected by that difference? And how does Peter sort of go through the world in that knowledge of being fifth generation?
So Primrose, I think, very much has echoes of myself, and I'm one of those people who's probably guilty of perpetuating the idea of a model minority, because I have always been quiet and docile, agreeable, not really that assertive. And so I think I really kind of perpetuated that. And I think Primrose is in some ways the same. She's very quiet. She internalises a lot, doesn't say much, even in sort of heated situations. But I really wanted to provide readers with an alternative, which is where Peter comes in. You know, when people talk about the Chinese diaspora, sometimes that term is kind of used as a way of kind of all like almost homogenizing every person in the world who has a Chinese heritage. You know, but actually within that, there's a multitude of ways in which people perceive themselves. Peter is someone who basically rejects any kind of categorization and just says, as long as I'm a decent human being, I do not need to put myself in a category. So in a way, he's refusing to look at himself or look at his reflection in a mirror that's held up to him by society. He knows who he is and that's that.
But can't he do that because he's male and rich?
Yeah, I mean, there's that too, obviously, yes. Yeah, so I mean, in terms of family history, they are very different. But I think in Peter lies the hope that with time, perhaps, that some of that insecurity about who you are and where you belong washes away. So that is the hope. And, you know, I have children, so my hope for them is that their sense of anxiety about their identity would be much more diluted than what I would be, you know, experiencing myself.
And, in fact, Primrose's father has an interesting approach to being the model minority. What does he do?
So he plays the trumpet at the park.
As you do.
Believing that it is a way of pulling people together, that music is a common... He plays music from films like Harry Potter and Star Wars and so on, and believing that it's a kind of glue that can gel people together and remind people to be nice to each other effectively. And actually, my dad's probably going to hate me for saying this, but my dad plays the trumpet. And
he's here.
Yeah, and he's also here. And he used to go... My mother found it very irritating for him to be playing the trumpet at home, so he used to go to Elsternwick Park and stand up on a hill and play the trumpet. So he became a bit of a local identity for a split second, and you know, people would sort of walk by and take videos of him and put them on Facebook, presumably. And so that was kind of where the that idea came from.
Yeah. Hopefully it worked out better for your dad than the father in the book.
Oh, yes. No, there's just echoes of my father, but not so much, yeah, not the entirety of my father.
So now I do want to talk about racism, because you have sort of mentioned it, and it is a central part of your book, Tracy, because, I mean, ultimately the reason that Key has to go out and find out what happened to her brother is because the police aren't doing it, and surely that's because it's an all-white police force in this Vietnamese community, and that's just an example of institutionalised racism, isn't it?
Yeah, so when I was doing my research into Cabramatta in the 90s, what I found was that there were a lot of politicians seizing on the opportunity to make the case that here is an example of multiculturalism's failure. Here is why multiculturalism doesn't work. We have a predominantly multiracial community and look at how it's falling apart. And clearly there's something wrong with this community. And there was something wrong with the community, which was untreated, undiagnosed PTSD with a lack of social services, a lack of support, and complete abandonment from the people in charge. Mm. But of course, people will cherry pick whatever suits their political agenda. And so seeing that, I was like, okay, this is, if we look at, I guess, what's happening in, well, what had happened in Cabramatta, depending on where you were viewing things from, you know, you got a very different picture.
Mm. Gosh, it sounds so similar to the narrative around the African gang violence now, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, and it just gets recycled, right? Yeah. Like, you know, after the 90s, we had post-9/11 Australia. And so, yes. Like, how were people of Middle Eastern heritage treated? Mm-hmm. And then when I was here in, I think, 2012, 2013, you turn on the news and it's African gangs. And it's like, it's just one scapegoat after another. And there's just a lack of reckoning with, like, why do we keep doing that? Mm. Mm.
For me, there was a pivotal moment in, I think, October 2020, when Senator Erica Betts, in front of a Senate committee hearing, singled out the three Chinese Australians in attendance and demanded that they publicly denounce the Chinese Communist Party. That was a very chilling moment for me, actually, because, you know, at that point, I was like, oh, so does that mean that we could move towards a world in which no matter who you are, as long as you look Chinese, the assumption will be that you are a supporter of the enemy state unless you specifically prove yourself to be otherwise? You know, it's the kind of stuff that makes itself into history books and not in a great, not in a good way. And so, you know, you see that just repeated over and over. You saw that with Japanese Americans during the Second World War, you know. You saw that with Muslim people in the aftermath of 9/11. And now you do see it maybe in a subtle way sometimes, but also in an explicit way sometimes with the Chinese Australian community too.
Yeah, and I think the thing with both our books is that sometimes there is a response from readers that's like, oh, this is about a migrant struggle, right? This is about an immigrant struggle. But a lot of the characters in both of our novels were born and raised in Australia, and yet they experience. So it's not an immigrant struggle. It's race-related, and people don't really want to acknowledge that.
And it sort of gets to this idea of conditional citizenship that you're talking about.
Yes,
and then how does that affect your sense of belonging?
You know, when I was younger, I had this naive notion that when you reach a certain age, you will simply get to a point where you feel like you belong fully and you're completely confident in who you are. The older that I get, the more I think it's not a linear journey at all. It goes up and down, you know. And what complicates it is that, like, the way in which you can categorize yourself is endless. So when I'm overseas and people ask me where I'm from, I will say I'm from Australia. When I'm in Australia and people ask me where I'm from, I'll say I'm from China, at which point they'll say, oh, your English is great. And I'll say, thank you. And then when Asian Australians ask me where I'm from, then they really want to be specific, right? Like, oh, you're from China. But like, what do you mean China? Oh, well, I'm from mainland China. You know, where in China? Oh, well, from Shanghai. And are you one of those people that came when you were a child or when you were older? Like, that all makes a difference in how people perceive you. It's kind of like, where you're from is extremely important. It's like a little microchip that's kind of embedded in your, so one day if you're lost in the desert, people find you, they'll go, oh yeah, that's who she is, you know. And it gets kind of manipulated all the time because of geopolitical tension. This is something that I've only started feeling in recent years, that what happens at the macro level can so influence who you are and how society perceives you. Just to give you an example, so the American actress Mila Kunis, at the outbreak of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, came out, I think preemptively, before anyone even asked her, came out to say, by the way, I do speak Russian, but I was born in Ukraine, right? So what that shows is that people are very aware of how, you know, where they are from and their family heritage can affect their identity. And I don't know if there's an answer to sort of solve this conundrum for people, but I think it's just, I think, worth articulating so that we are kind of all aware that there is a conundrum.
Yeah, I think so much of it is affected by how people treat you. So I know that I'm Australian. I know that this is where I'm from. This is the accent I speak with. And yet it's when someone treats you a certain way and it is incredibly jarring and you're not really sure what to do with that. I think that is where the tension lies to me, where it's like, oh, I know I belong, and yet someone has just said something, or a politician has just said something, or I've been treated a certain way, or I've witnessed someone get treated a certain way, and it just sort of, it's like you're sitting in a chair and then a spring like just throws you out of the chair and you're like, whoa, what happened? And just that happening repeatedly and not really knowing what to do with that feeling.
I liken that to, like, you know, sometimes you put on a really nice outfit and you, like, in your head you think you look a certain way and that you look great, and then someone takes a photo of you and you go, that's not like how I'm supposed to look, you know. It's like that, right? Like, you just constantly, like, the feedback is not the same as what you think internally.
And the thing is, it can be so subtle, right? Like, I think that so many Australians are incredibly well-intentioned.
Absolutely.
And yet we all have, like, prejudices and biases that we're not completely aware of. So sometimes you might be asked a question, like, you know, I've been told, like, oh, your English is great. And I'd be like, I would hope so. You know, or, for example, you know, sometimes someone will be like, how does someone who came from a family where, you know, English is not the first language, how did you learn to write so well? And I'm like, I went to school, you know? And again, like, these are such, they're well-intentioned. You know, these people don't have a mean bone in their bodies. And yet it's that subtle, it's that jarring feeling. Where it's like, oh, people see me and they see an Asian person before they see an Australian person. And again, it's just sort of like having to sit with that feeling and be like, oh, a lot of people don't have to think about this ever.
So we've come to that point in the conversation where we could go to questions from the audience, or we could all just keep talking. What is your feeling out there in terms of preference? So hands up if we keep talking. That is a majority. Just hands up if you want Q&A. That is a negative. So we're going to keep talking. So so in response to these issues that you're discussing, is that where literature can come in, and writing these books and adding your voice? You know, adding your voice that was silenced for those years when you came to Australia, and putting these stories into the mix. These are Australian stories.
Right. I think for the longest time, Australia has exported a very narrow image of itself. So I live in America now and have been there for 10 years. And whenever Americans think of Australians, they think of the outback or blonde surfers at Bondi Beach. And it's like, and me. and even, I think even within Australia, like, if you look at the census from, I think it was 2016, about nearly 25% of people in Sydney identified as having Asian heritage. Nearly 20% of all Australians identified having Asian heritage. Turn on the TV, see how many Asians are on TV. Like, tune into Neighbours. When was the last time they had an Asian lead?
I think Li Lian Chin was probably the only Asian on TV through the 90s.
For a very long time.
And so I think broadcaster.
And so I think the problem with when you export a very narrow image of it is that people buy into it without even realising it. And so I see, like, writing literature, writing television, writing movies, whatever it is, as diversifying that narrative so that, yes, the suburbs are also Australian and the city is also Australian. And, like, the main thing for me is wanting to be entertaining, because I think no matter how, like, potent your message is, if people don't want to read it, then it's just sort of stuck in a book somewhere. So my first goal is to entertain. And then if the story inspires any form of reflection, then that is a huge win. Mm-hmm. You know, if you reflect on, okay, what have I done that might have made someone feel marginalized? Or even if you like read a story and you feel seen or you relate to it in some way, mm-hmm. or it makes a certain community more complex in your mm-hmm. eyes, mm-hmm. I see that as all good things.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, I wholeheartedly agree with everything that Tracy said. One of the things that I really was trying to do with this story in particular was to break the stereotype of the way the Asian male is portrayed in popular culture in the West. And, you know, I was very adamant that I would have to make Peter, the character of Peter, into kind of Asian Miss Darcy type, you know, to just to break that mold of how people perceive Asian men in general. And there's a particular scene in the book where, you know, like Peter's swimming in the ocean in the middle of winter and he emerges onto the beach and proceeds to, you know, strip down his wetsuit. And that was a very intentional thing, right? Like, is it strictly necessary to the narrative? Probably not, but but it was entertaining. And I had great fun writing it.
It was your Mr. Dusty moment.
Yeah, and in a way, I was sort of hoping that that would really appeal to the romantic heart of the female readers and or whoever out there, you know. So it's about kind of breaking the stereotype and insisting that the alternative has a place in mainstream culture.
Yeah, that's, exporting another narrative.
Yes, another
exporting
narrative.
An image yes. of like hot yes. Asian dudes.
Hot Asian dudes, yes, exactly.
More hot Asian
hot
dudes.
Hot Asian dudes. Like,
we can start a chant.
Thirst trap, I think that's the term that's
sure.
now used. Thirst trap, yeah, I don't know what that means, but yeah, like a hot person is called
Just like drooling.
Yeah, so more Asian thirst traps.
Right, I was not expecting the conversation to go here. And I guess the extension of that is to have these stories in books and then to see it on the screen. I mean, wouldn't it be great if we had the Crazy Rich Asians for mm-hmm. Australia to have
yes.
your books then put onto the screen and then for that actually to not be... to not have to talk about it as an issue, like that this is just normal. Of course you're going to put these characters
that's
on
right,
the screen.
Yeah. And it's starting to happen more and more, I feel. So that's very, you know, lovely to see. Michelle Yeoh, right? So it is starting to happen, which is great. But it's a slow movement. You know, Marlon Brando, I think, rejected the Oscar back in the 70s or 80s. And his reason was to sort of like as a protest to how Hollywood was portraying these minority groups. And it's taken us so many decades to get to where we are, but the work is still to be, there's more work to be done. Yeah.
Now, we are coming to the end of our conversation. It's been a really rich, wonderful conversation, but I just need to tie things up because, Nina, you sort of mentioned that you're one of the reasons that you went on this writing journey is because you were dealing with a lot of things, and one of which was that your husband has cancer. So I think we all need to know, is your husband okay?
Yes, he's in remission and he's looking great. He's right there.
So
you can look at him. You can look at him yourself. So it's good.
that's really good to hear. And I think you'll all agree this has been a really wonderful conversation. There are such wonderful storytellers in Australia, and I'm glad that COVID has provided the means for people to sit down and write those stories. So Nina Wan and Tracy Lien's books are available to purchase here at the festival, and then you can get them signed. And there are some wonderful volunteers who will direct you to exactly where to go. If you're not sure, find your Melbourne Writers Festival volunteers and they will let you know. Please support your local writers. The best way to do that is to read their books and to tell your friends about them. Nina Wan's novel is The Albatross. Tracy Lien's is All That's Left Unsaid. Please thank Nina Wan and Tracy Lien.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this discussion and would like to support Melbourne Writers Festival, visit mwf.com.au/support.